Chapter 5. Is China's Economy Modern? In December 2014, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, reported that the Chinese economy was worth $17.6 trillion, slightly exceeding the $17.4 trillion estimate for the US. This marked the first time since 1872 that the US had not topped the list of the world's largest economies. One should note that these figures were adjusted for purchasing power parity, PPP, without which the size of China's economy would seem much smaller, and most measures do still categorize China as the second biggest rather than biggest global economy. Yet the IMF statistic highlighted the paradox of China's status in the 21st century. Economic superpower that moves the world's markets? Impoverished developing country? Or both? China's economy grew at around 10% per year in the first decade of the 21st century, one of the highest sustained rates of wealth creation in world history. The rate of growth seems all the more astounding because it's contrasted with the relatively inward-looking Mao period and the era of war that preceded it. Yet it was not entirely unprecedented. The growth in the Chinese economy marked something of a return to the early modern era, when the Chinese economy was comparable with those of Europe. The 20th century was undoubtedly a troubled time for the Chinese economy, particularly for its huge agricultural sector, which was devastated by war, depression, and the impact, within a short number of years, of not enough government under the nationalists and too much under the communists. The characteristics of a modern economy include an active enthusiasm for growth, capital investment and industrialization, and ever-increasing productivity through the development of technology. In those terms, China's economy, particularly since 1978, measures up spectacularly. Among the key factors have been foreign direct investment, FDI, cheap labor, and the immense importance of overseas Chinese financial and human investment, as well as continuing investment in education and scientific and technical research and development. However, there have been real drawbacks to this growth. In particular, the rise in Chinese consumption and the impact of unrestricted production on China's environment have stored up immense and expensive problems for the next generation of Chinese leaders. The origins of the modern Chinese economy. To trace the origins of China's engagement with the modern globalized economy, we need to go back over 1,000 years. The Song Dynasty saw one of the major changes in the Chinese economy. Up to that point, the majority of farmers were subsistence cultivators, but by the end of the dynasty, they'd become specialists, producing cash crops or making goods for the market. At the same time, a countrywide internal market developed in China, which would go on to expand under the Ming and Qing. A paper and metal money economy also thrived during this period, leading to financial crises and increasing contrasts between the very rich and very poor. Yet overall, it was clear that this was a time of immense growth for the Chinese economy, and it was certainly comparable with the increasingly commercial nature of the European economy of the time. However, half a millennium later, events in the economies of Europe and China would differ greatly. China's economy essentially produced more of the same. The 18th century in particular was a golden time for China. Its territory expanded as the Qing conquered lands to the west and the north. The introduction of new world grains in previous decades had expanded the number of crops that could be grown on land that had previously been considered barren, allowing the population to spread and grow. By the end of the 18th century, China's population had doubled from 150 to 300 million people. The same period, of course, saw a revolution in Europe, starting in England, the agrarian and industrial revolutions of the modern era. The historian Kenneth Pomerantz has been particularly associated with a specific question. Why was there a great divergence between Europe and China in the 18th century? He argued that Europe's most advanced area, England, and China's, the Yangtze Valley, were at a comparable level of development in around 1800. Why, then, was it England that saw unprecedented, dynamic growth? His argument was based on a number of factors, but principal among them was that England had benefited from conveniently sited coal mines and colonies, neither of which was available in the Yangtze Delta at the same time. While there's been lively debate about specific details, there's now considerable consensus that it is meaningful to compare the economies of early modern England and China in terms of their relative stage of economic dynamism and growth. Nonetheless, the Great Divergence did take place. China developed an ever more commercial economy in the late imperial era, but until the late 19th century it did not develop the type of industrial modernity seen in the West. This changed, inevitably, with the advent of Western imperialism in the mid-19th century, which brought about profound changes both to China's industrial and agricultural economy. The collision with imperialism and industrialization. The problems of rural China were not just of Western making. By the late 18th century, signs of an agricultural crisis in the Chinese countryside were evident. Over a century later, in the 1930s, the British economist R.H. Tawney was moved by the plight of China's peasants to declare, "There are districts in which the position of the rural population is that of a man standing up to the neck in water so that even a ripple is sufficient to drown him." For years, it seemed self-evident that the rural economy in China was a disaster in the period before 1949. Yet, over the past 20 years or so, serious reassessments have been made. These have led to strongly opposing views as to causation, but the old view that China's agricultural crisis was bad and getting worse all the way into the mid-1930s is highly misleading. One of the major reasons that China's peasant economy in the century from the 1840s to the 1940s has come in for such criticism is the turbulent nature of the times. However, economic historians no longer make the assumption, common enough from the mid-20th century until around the 1980s, that tumultuous politics necessarily led to disastrous consequences for the Chinese economy. In fact, there is significant evidence that, after the late Qing crisis, the overall agricultural economy of China became more productive and profitable. The historian, Lauren Brand, argued that between the 1890s and 1930s, agricultural output in central and east China increased more than two times the estimated population growth of 0.6% per annum. He attributed this to various factors. One was increasing specialization, including the growing of cash crops such as cotton. Commercial and technological factors also changed things. By the 1930s, more than 40% of all farm households in that region were using commercial fertilizers, and rural credit was becoming easier to obtain. Seed development, including higher-yielding varieties of rice, were also coming into usage. Yet the economy remained a very poor one. In the mid-1930s, per capita GNP was only 60 yuan, around $200. China had been significantly involved in trade within Asia for centuries, and had played a major part in the luxury goods market in Europe in the 18th century, providing tea, porcelain, and silks in return for silver. But China only entered the international market fully in the modern era. This was a dubious blessing, because that international market was in large part a function of imperialist attempts to open China up. Nonetheless, China's semi-colonial status did give it a level of economic autonomy that a true colony, such as India, did not have, particularly after the nationalists managed to regain autonomy to set tariffs, taxes on imports, by the early 1930s. The Sino-Japanese War would cripple China's economy, just as it destroyed China's state-building experiment of the same era. Not enough research has yet been done on agricultural production in wartime China, but there can be no doubt that the war dealt a heavy blow to the progress made in the decades before 1937. China's transport networks were destroyed, and large parts of its agricultural land were laid waste by war. Not everything was lost. Good harvests in the first year of the war meant that the breadbasket province of Sichuan was able to supply the areas of China under nationalist control, and the government continued experimentation with fertilizers and new seed varieties. But wartime did not provide anything like normal conditions to assess economic progress. The final years of the war saw the economy collapse. Scarcity of consumer goods led to black marketeering and hyperinflation. The loss of important agricultural areas to the Japanese during the offensives of 1943-4 led to widespread starvation in the countryside and increased the population's alienation from the nationalist government. Even after the war was over, the financial crisis continued throughout the 1946-9 civil war, and Chiang's government fled to Taiwan, leaving behind a crippled economy. Mao's China. It has become conventional to condemn Mao's China as an economic failure which ultimately forced the reform era of the 1980s on the government. While there is real substance to this argument, it's worth noting that there were developments during the Maoist period that provide favourable conditions for the eventual economic takeoff after 1978. Despite an initial accommodation with capitalists, the new economy of Mao's China was established by 1952. Mao's China was always going to have a socialist command economy. Emerging as it did at the start of the Cold War as an ally of the USSR, there was little ideological possibility of China following a different economic model. In addition, the new People's Republic of China, PRC, became part of a post-war Soviet-driven system of economic cooperation, signing trade agreements with most of the newly communist Eastern European countries and benefiting from Soviet technical assistance. The terms of such assistance were often favourable to China, with Moscow providing steel and factory fittings in return for pork and tobacco. Sometimes the PRC also made gestures of solidarity, as in 1953, when it dispatched food to East Germany after East Berlin had been shaken by protests against the government. Nonetheless, the pressure that shaped China's economy during this period did not only come from one side. The United States made a decision not to recognize the establishment of the PRC in 1949, and along with non-recognition came a trade embargo by the US and its allies. Although other nations, such as Japan, did begin to carry on informal international trade with China, the country still appeared isolated from the non-communist world. In addition, relations with the USSR began to sour from the mid-1950s and were actively hostile by the mid-1960s. In that context, China's leaders began to think in terms of a siege economy that could be defended in the context of a catastrophe, such as an American-sponsored attempt by Chiang Kai-shek to retake the mainland or a Soviet attack across the northern border. Many economists condemned this decision in retrospect, arguing that it moved much of China's industry away from the coastal areas, from where goods could be more easily exported after production. However, others have noted that the influx of investment into Western China actually improved living standards and provided the basis for later development, such as higher literacy rates, industrial plant, transport infrastructure, and water conservancy projects. In fact, some of these factors have become even more relevant since the 1990s, when the government chose to develop the policy of opening up the West, encouraging migration away from China's overpopulated East to the less developed Western regions. The establishment of the Three Gorges Dam project has also helped to cement the importance of the southwestern city of Chongqing, now a regional powerhouse and, at least on paper, China's biggest city in terms of population. The economy under Mao suffered grievously in many ways, of which the Great Leap Forward is the most notorious. However, in its own terms, it also succeeded in its immediate goals. Unlike nationalist China, the PRC did not collapse under the weight of its own economic problems. The features for which the PRC economy under Mao has been criticized, import substitution, trying to become self-sufficient, low production of consumer goods, were also factors in a variety of democratic countries during the era from the 1950s to the 1980s, including India and New Zealand. These countries, like China, began to take a different path in the 1980s. China in the global economy. Economic reform started in the countryside, with farmers given freedom to sell their crops on the free market and individuals encouraged to set up enterprises. Chapter 3. In the early 1980s, Deng Xiaoping established the Special Economic Zones, SEZs, in port cities on China's southern coast. This signaled his desire to lay down the first phase of economic growth. It would start with manufacturing and light industry, and would be fueled by foreign investment, which would be tempted in by highly preferential tax rates and labour laws. The opening up of Shanghai in the 1990s provided further impetus to this policy. Up to that point, the city had been heavily restricted in the amount of foreign direct investment it was allowed to attract. There was excellent precedent for this strategy, as Deng knew. In the late 19th century, Meiji Japan, forced into breakneck modernization, financed its economic growth by developing export-led growth in areas such as textiles, and only later developing heavy industry. In the aftermath of World War II, Japan and its dragon counterparts, Taiwan, South Korea and Hong Kong, also rose to economic prosperity on light industry and consumer goods, heavily encouraged by their governments. During the same period, of course, Mao's China had been turning inward. The export-oriented strategy has been spectacularly successful so far. There were danger points. One of the economic factors that fueled urban protests in 1988-9 was the rapidly growing inflation rate, which severely reduced the purchasing power of state employees, a situation, had it gone out of control, that would have been frighteningly reminiscent of the hyperinflation that doomed the nationalists in 1948-9. Yet the situation was brought under control, and in the early 21st century, inflation is generally in single digits, even as consumer spending rises with the creation of a new middle class. Although state ownership of industries and enterprises is clearly declining, the state and the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, are still heavily entwined with business. Party officials have frequently switched from taking a political role to an entrepreneurial one, and good relations with the CCP are often essential to win licenses to do business or to raise capital to set one up. The state and the party have changed form immeasurably since the era of Mao, but neither has retreated from society. They've merely found new ways to interact with and control it. The other dragons eventually gave up manufacturing cheap goods as the countries became richer, wages became higher, and ultimately it became cheaper to move manufacturing to other countries, usually China, in fact. The Chinese labour force is far larger and poorer than that in any other Asian country except India, and it will therefore take longer for its labour costs to price China out of the market, although there are signs that this is beginning to happen in some parts of the country. However, the leadership's plans are already developing for the stage of growth that follows their dominance of the manufacturing market. For the ultimate ambition of the Chinese leadership is not to be the workshop of the world, producing toys and clothes. From the start of the four modernizations, science and technology was one of the key targets for reform, and China's leaders have been well aware that Japan, Taiwan and Korea soon moved away from becoming manufacturing hubs to providing high-value-added goods to the world. In particular, China covets the quality and reputation of Japan's technological expertise. Investment in science, technology and innovation is now one of the government's top priorities, and total domestic spending on it in 2012 was some 1.98% of GDP, with the aim of spending 2.5% by 2020. Some multinationals are also investing in Chinese research. Microsoft and IBM both have significant basic research laboratories in Beijing. The global financial crisis of 2008-10 was a very significant moment for Beijing. In the second half of 2008, the collapse of Western economies severely damaged the export markets for Chinese goods, revealing that there had been too much capacity in the economy in the previous few years, and that too many goods were chasing too few customers. In November 2008, the government introduced a 4 trillion yuan stimulus package, an amount that was the equivalent of some 14% of 2008 GDP, as well as a monetary expansion policy for the next 2 years. At a time of contraction elsewhere, China's economy grew rapidly, with huge spending on infrastructure, including airports, railways and toll roads. By the mid-2010s, the concern was that China was once again suffering from overcapacity and that a turn to domestic consumption, rather than more building, was needed to keep growth rates up, along with a clampdown on irresponsible lending that came from the sudden influx of money into the economy. Yet there was no doubt that the overall success of China in avoiding the credit crunch and banking crisis that damaged the West gave it new credibility in the eyes of many countries in the global South. It was clear that the model of neoliberal economic modernity, which had shaped most Western economies until 2008, was not the only one on offer. Instead, a strong state sector and a controlled currency might have their advantages, at least in the short term. In the 2010s, the greatest challenge for Chinese policymakers will be to manage a lower rate of growth than in the boom years. The economy grew by 7.4% in 2014, a figure that would be the envy of most Western nations, but it was still well below the double-digit rates of the early 2000s. In an attempt to move away from growth fueled by spending on infrastructure, paid for by borrowing, the government has stressed consumption, trying to encourage the Chinese to spend more on consumer goods and services, for instance by inventing new public holidays that would encourage leisure travel and visits to restaurants and theme parks. As the government pledges to spend more on essentials such as healthcare, the state provision of which was largely eliminated during the reform period, consumers may be more willing to spend on non-essentials. Yet it is proving a hard task to encourage the Chinese to take their savings from under the mattress and spend them. After all, there have been a large number of rainy days in recent Chinese history. All of this matters to the rest of the world because China's economy has a central role in the global economy, something that was simply not true at the start of the reform era. For a start, its role as a manufacturing base is clear. In 2014, China's trade surplus with the rest of the world was $380 billion, a figure that was rising, not falling. China also protects its currency, keeping its value low against other currencies to make sure that Chinese exports are cheap in global terms and that imported goods remain costly. Under repeated pressure from the US and EU, China has gradually allowed the yuan to appreciate in value, but the People's Bank of China continues to maintain control over the level of that appreciation. However, China has not closed itself behind a protectionist wall. In 2001, it succeeded in a long campaign to join the World Trade Organization, WTO, even though WTO entry would force China to open up its markets for goods and services and to crack down on intellectual property rights violations. China has observed the path taken by Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan in the post-war era and has made calculations about how far and how quickly to open up its economy. Internationally, China is becoming ever more concerned about its own image because it's making its presence more prominent in Africa and Latin America, where it's becoming an exporter of finance capital, in sharp contrast with its desire to import foreign direct investment, FDI. In Africa in particular, it has used its influence to invest in countries such as Zambia, Zimbabwe, Nigeria, and South Africa, where minerals, uranium, and oil are found. Chinese investment has often been welcomed in countries such as Zimbabwe with bad human rights records, since that investment has not tended to come with demands on human rights standards, although Western observation of these demands has also been patchy to say the least. As governments change in Africa, the Chinese may find that having backed a previous, unpopular government has made them vulnerable with the new regime. This has led to a greater effort to use public diplomacy to suggest to African populations, as well as leaders, that Chinese investment is an asset for developing countries and that Beijing is not following in the West's colonial footsteps. China is also using its economic power to create new influence in its own region. In 2015, Beijing announced the establishment of an Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, AIIB, with $50 billion worth of funds. The aim of the bank is to provide funding for projects in the Asia-Pacific region, thereby providing an alternative to Western-influenced institutions and increasing goodwill to China. However, it still remains to be seen whether the AIIB will, in practice, reduce tensions in the region caused by a growing perception that China is seeking dominance, not just influence. Problems of growth. China is not only sharing some of the successes of the dragons that grew up in Asia during the Cold War, it also suffers from some of the same drawbacks, as well as new problems that were not thought of in the 1960s. Most noticeable to anyone who visits China is the level of environmental pollution that has come along with growth. This is not entirely a problem of the reform era. Plenty of Mao-era state-run factories poured chemicals into the air and water with abandon. However, the breakneck pace of economic growth since the 1980s made the problem many times worse. Japan, in the 1960s, during its period of fastest post-war growth, also had a serious pollution problem. However, there were factors that helped to overcome this, in part at least. The growth of environmental groups in civil society and press exposés of scandals, such as the poisoning of fish with mercury at Minamata, provided some sort of counterpoint to the agenda of government and big business, which were more interested in growing the economy. China lacks a true civil society, and environmental campaigners are kept within strict boundaries. The Chinese Ministry of Environmental Protection stated that $230 billion in 2010 of direct losses to the economy had been caused by pollution, around 3% of China's entire gross domestic product. One of the largest internal drivers to Chinese economic growth is the development of an urban middle class with a high-consuming lifestyle. At the same time, the country's level of consumption is proving an immense strain on resources. A generation ago, Beijing was a city of bicycles. Now it is a warren of endless traffic jams. Its public transport system is being expanded, but is insufficient for the city's size. In Beijing, the authorities plan to limit the number of cars to only 6 million by 2017, see Figure 10. The growth of car ownership encapsulates a wider problem, China's energy crisis. Pomerantz's model of the Great Divergence was predicated in part on Britain's good luck in having access to fossil fuels in the 18th century. The strain on China's supply of such fuel in the 21st century has produced serious restrictions on its potential to grow. Although China has coal supplies, they're of low quality and highly polluting, and its oil supply is limited. This has led it into a much closer partnership with Russia, which supplies China by pipeline, but Russia has other customers and cannot be guaranteed to be reliable in the long term. Nuclear energy is another option, but world supplies of uranium are also limited, although China's new friendliness with African nations, such as South Africa, gives it further access to the raw materials needed. China's desire to move population westward is hobbled by the same problem that the US had in its push west, lack of water. China's hinterland had always been underpopulated for a good reason. It was arid land, incapable of producing many crops. Now that official policy is to open up the west, the problem of water supply must be solved. Unfortunately, there have been cases of rivers in western China that traditionally flowed downstream into Southeast Asia being diverted to water western China, leaving parts of Vietnam dry. The prospect of water wars, virtual or real, is in the minds of governments around the region. Most of all, China has become the world's largest emitter of carbon into the atmosphere, producing 28% of the world's emissions in 2013. China's middle class is still small compared to its much poorer rural population. When the latter become richer, and when China's very high national savings rate reduces as consumers start buying more, the effects on the global environment could be catastrophic. Another persistent problem remains: lack of transparency and the corruption that comes along with it. It is still illegal to reveal state economic statistics, including basic economic information that would be public in many economies, and China's new 2015 national security law includes economic and financial data within its definition of security. The organization Transparency International releases an annual survey of perceived corruption around the world. In 2014, China scored 36 on a scale of 0 to 100, with 100 being least corrupt, slightly more corrupt than India at 38, but less than Vietnam at 31. China's operation of law is still instrumental rather than principled, though various aspects of corporate and criminal law have been revised, often with some operational success. The party still stands above the law, making it hard to operate the rule of law in the classic sense. Economic modernity? Is China's economy part of the modern world? In some ways, it seems to reflect assumptions very different from the espousal of free markets and withdrawal of the state that were heard in the West in the 1990s and beyond. The state and party are heavily involved in the Chinese economy, as well as its overseas investments, and the market is still hard for outsiders to penetrate, despite China's entry to the WTO in 2001. Corruption and lack of transparency cloud attempts to divine the real story of what is happening in China's economy. Yet China's economy now matters to everyone in the world. In manufactured goods, financial services, and currency and interest rates, China's influence is undeniable. While adapting to the world of the modern, globalized economy, China has also forced the world to reshape its economy, at least in part, to Chinese needs.